Good evening, everyone. I'm sorry I missed last week. I don't remember what I was doing, but I couldn't be here. So it's a pleasure to be back with you. I remember Norman Fisher saying once, the Zen teacher, the American Zen teacher, Norman Fisher, saying once that people would ask him about the Buddhist view of things. They would say, what is the Buddhist view of this? Or what is the Buddhist view of that? And he would always have a little difficulty because he would say, there is no Buddhist view of this or that. The Buddhist view is non-view. And I was thinking about that. Well, I guess that comes back to me regularly because we live in a world in which you're supposed to have a position and a view of something. And you're supposed to hold on to that and argue about it or try to convince other people about it. And I suppose we could say that even Norman's, the Buddhist view is non-view, could be a position. However, it's not. It can't be. It's an attitude, it's a spirit, it's a being, a way of being. It's a spirit of openness, kindness, flexibility, tolerance, that arises from taking I out of our thinking. You know, stepping out of the confines, the limits of self. So we can look at very many different situations when we have trouble with that, when we are caught in the confines of self, and when we are, I is the principal subject and object of our thoughts. And then how we behave when that's happening. And the difficulties that we have with being with people, our Zen practice is really so good for that. And retreats are so good for that. So our Zen practice of sitting down on our cushion, submitting to that discipline for 30 minutes like we just did, submitting to a discipline, a regimen that we normally wouldn't be doing, right? That allows us to, that's exactly what allows us to step outside the confines of self, of ourself. That, you know, it helps us to liberate ourselves from ourselves, as we say. We're staying in the silence and directing our attention inwards instead of directing our attention outwards to all the chatter, all of the distractions, all of the activity, the goals, the building, grasping, pushing away, all of that. So we submit to this regimen of just sitting for however long. And so for however long we do it, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 3 days, 7 days, however long we do that, we are taking self out of the equation. Liberating ourselves from ourselves. Whether we realize it or not, that's what we're doing. Okay. And someone was telling me recently about how I said something like, okay, well, so what comes up when you sit with your coma? And he said, well, you know, I don't really sit with my comas. So I said, why? And he said, well, because I have such a busy mind, I'm always thinking and trying to figure things out intellectually, that I spend my whole time sitting trying to liberate myself from that. And I feel like if I then start thinking about my koan, if I bring my koan into that, then that will just generate more thought, logic, grasping, intellectual patterns. And there is some, this is something I hear regularly from people, and I can understand it, where that's coming from. However, and what I usually say to people is that that moment when we're sitting, however long that moment lasts, it's true we need to have our minds stabilized. We need to be not floating around like a butterfly all over the place. But there's a certain modicum of stability. And at that point, we can bring up the question of whatever our koan is. And the effect is not the same as bringing up a math problem or figuring out what you need to say to your boss so that you get a raise, or how are you going to speak to your mother on Mother's Day, or are you going to speak to your mother on Mother's Day, or whatever it is that you're, you know, chewing on. A koan is not like that. Koan is not that kind of thought. And because you can't resolve it with that kind of thought. The koan is like the key to opening the confines of self. It's it's what allows to take the I out of the thinking. Otherwise, it cannot be addressed. So it's tricky, you know. You say, okay, well, I don't want to think too much, so when I'm sitting, I just want to clear my mind. Great, exactly. Koan is not about thinking too much, and it's not about clogging up your mind. And the same thing applies to people who aren't working on koans. Can we sit and be with what is without entering into the usual discourse about what is here? Principally me, and all that I think and feel and believe. And can I take the I out of that equation? And enter that spirit of openness that, you know, that Norman talks about, the non-view. Thich Nhat Hanh actually said that this spirit of openness and tolerance that characterizes Buddhism and is a result of taking I out of thinking is what has always guaranteed Buddhism's ability to adapt wherever it finds itself. That's what allows Wildflower Sangha to exist in this form. We have no set place where we live, where we sit together, and yet everywhere we go is that place. Because we are open, we're tolerant, flexible, kind to ourselves, kind to each other, kind to the place where we find ourselves sitting, wherever it is. And not attaching to I, how I want it to be, how I think it should be, where I want to be or don't want to be. And you can see this in your daily lives. I recently, my sister asked me, my sister who lives in New York and works for a magazine, said one of her colleagues was going to be in Paris just for the day, and asked me if I could meet her. You know, she'd never been to Paris before. In fact, I think it was her first time in Europe. She was worried about getting a COVID test before having to return to London and then fly back. So could I help her get a COVID test, maybe have lunch with her or something? So I said, okay. And it's not something that I wanted to spend my day doing. Certainly not like tourist stuff. Like I had only a few hours. She had the full day, I only had a few hours. And she wanted to go to the Arc de Triomphe, the Champs-Élysées, the Louvre, the Eiffel Tower, Notre Dame, Montmartre, shopping, and I was like, whoa. And get a COVID test, have lunch. But I took the I out of my thinking. And just, of course I had my limits. I had a certain amount of time, and I know that everything she wanted, even in the amount of time she had, was impossible. And so I just did it. I just spent time with her. And helped her, set priorities of what on that list was the most important, because it wasn't all going to happen. And at a certain moment, I was going to have to leave. And she kind of tried to convince me, change your meeting, or I can't convince you to stay out with me tonight. And I, no. And, but I didn't have a hard time saying that, because it wasn't like I was attached to myself. I could say, you might think, well, I would feel guilty. But I didn't, because that was just what I had to do. And it wasn't about me. And I was open to whatever, in those few hours I had with her, whatever would happen. And trying to meet her where she was, which was this, American who had never been to Europe before and had no clue. At first she thought I was going to meet her in my car and we were going to drive around. And then I quickly dispelled that notion, and then she couldn't believe how much time we were spending in the metro. And I was like, well, the stuff you want to see and do is far and wide. And yet, because I was not judging, meaning I was not putting my eye into the thinking and not having a fixed view of her, of the situation, of myself, where I would rather have been or something, it's fine. It was good. And when I left her, it was no big deal. I left her at Galerie Lafayette and I said, do your thing. And that was it. Would have been completely different had I had been stuck in the confines of myself. And I think you can relate to that when you've been in situations where you are really attached to you and what you want and don't want and judgment and how things should be or shouldn't be, and then what happens. And I'm sure you have experiences too where that doesn't happen. But that's what our practice is about. Over and over again, sitting, and it erases selfishness. It breaks down the boundaries of the confines, not boundaries, but the confines that we're locked in. Timeless moment after timeless moment, sitting, turning your attention inwards. And then that changes how you move in the world. It changes who you want to associate with, the activities you want to be involved with. It changes your relationship to yourself. You can see aspects of yourself in a different light. You enter that this kind of a silent eternity, you know, of just this moment, and realizing your full potential in just this moment. A friend that I've had for decades, who I lived my first year in Paris together. You know, we shared a flat with some people. And she then went back to the US, and we've stayed friends, even though we don't see each other very often. And after I began practicing, I had just met Geno Roshi, like, who was Geno Sensei, who was Catherine at the time. And I went to visit my friend in the US, and I was so enthusiastic about it. I talked about it all the time, the Zen practice, and wow, this was amazing, and it was an amazing experience of the absolute, and it was like the prophet of bliss, and and I said to her, yeah, and I had this teacher, I had a Zen teacher, and she's a monk. I didn't know anything about transmission and stuff. Well, it wasn't a year. She had only had transmission for a few months at this time. And my friend said, oh, and she was listening to me and everything. She said, well, you know what? I think you're going to do that too. You're going to be a monk. I can see. And I didn't really go there. I had a small child. I was a single mother. I had a full-time job. What was I going to be, a monk? I mean, no. But I never forgot that she said that. And it always intrigued me. And recently she was here visiting, and we spent just a couple afternoons together. And she asked me again, you know, she asked me about my practice, and I said, well, you know, you were actually right, that I am. I am that. Even though I'm not, officially a monk, I'm not ordained, I have no aspiration for that, that's what I am, in the sense that submitting to this regimen of turning the silence, to entering silence and turning my attention inward, and liberating myself from myself moment to moment. That's what a monk is. That's what monks do. You don't need to have that title. And it doesn't have to be any big deal. But she was right, my friend. I guess she realized at that moment, knowing me, she knew that's where I was heading, even though this was like 30 years ago. And so each of us in that moment when we're sitting, and we are one with whatever is arising, you're a monk in that moment. Meaning you're fully committed to that moment, whatever it is. Not holding back I. Giving yourself to whatever it is. And it's like that, it's a second, right? You're sitting there on your cushion and suddenly, just boom. And then it all starts again. All the stuff starts again. That's fine. That one is enough to remind us to come back again and again, to turn our attention back to us here instead of out captured by all of that stuff. And entering into this non-view in which all of that stuff that sometimes seems so important isn't anymore so important. The getting, you know, the famous phrase of getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. So trying to accumulate and gain and become, accomplish, we miss just this. We miss just this beautiful gem of you in this moment. And that's the big Buddhist non-view. Of just this, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, famous, you know, for peace is every step or something like that. Because he came to the West not to bring Zen practice, but as a peace activist. But his peace activism was deeply grounded and born from his deep Zen practice. This deep practice of stepping outside the confines of the self, taking the I out of thinking. So, that's the Buddhist non-view, let's say. Which isn't even Buddhist. You know, the Buddha would not have called this Buddhism. So we call it Buddhist because it has the flavor that he gave it, but it actually doesn't belong to him or to us. It's our true nature. Okay. If anyone wants to say anything, share anything, ask a question. Debbie.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. What you just said, I'm not sure I understand. The Buddha would not find what we do to be Buddhism. There are a bunch of ways of understanding that from my point of view. What exactly do you mean?
Well, because, you know, the Buddha, he was just this guy doing his thing. He didn't give it a name. Uh-huh. It didn't create a doctrine. There still is no doctrine, but he didn't call it anything. You know, it's like Christ would not have called himself a Christian. So when we put the labels on it, of course we know why we do that, but I think it's helpful it's really kind of refreshing to remember that in the origin, it wasn't that. It's like, you know, if your mother made a great potato salad, and then it passes down through the generations, you know, great grandma's potato salad, you know, or something. When she was making it, it wasn't, you know, anything great. It was just how she made potato salad. So the Buddha was not creating anything. He was just sharing his experience of the world. We now call it the Buddhist non-view, but it doesn't belong to Buddhism. It's not even Buddhist in that sense.
Were they called anything? Because early Christians were probably called something by the rest of society. I don't know what they were. They weren't called Christians, but they were called followers of Nazareth or something. Were early Buddhists called something?
I don't think so. No. And I'm not sure with Christians. I mean, they were Jews, actually.
There must have been a name for them at some point, so they could hate them. And we don't like those guys.
Could be, you know, yeah. Probably very quickly then they started calling them Christians. Mm. Followers of Christ. Probably after he died even, you know. Until then, they just called them these crazy people following around this heretic, you know. It was like, or worse than that.
Hi, everyone. It's not a question or comment. It's just I'd just like to point out that I like the fact that we can put in the same sentence great-grandmother's potato salad and just this thing, Zen being just this thing, just simple. And it's great. Potato salad and sitting down are the same thing. It's quite a teaching.
Yeah, it is. Yep. Because when we take the I out of things, then every single thing, person, moment, however humble, however grand, is it. It's not it because we insert the I into it. But when we can do that, and we can step back and the I is not involved in the thinking, it's all just this, wow. It's all it. Lots of stuff comes up for me, like, you know, so in retreats, when it creeps up on us. We don't even really realize it. But, you know, you're sitting there in retreat, eating an Oreo key, and some tiny little thing that the server does. The way the server reaches for the towel and then wipes up a speck of water that's spilled. Or the way the server forgets to bow, or the sound of scraping of the bowls, or just the tiniest little things. We realize, we see them, but we're not thinking of it as being anything extraordinary. And yet we feel, we're touched by it. Whereas if we were not in that context, we wouldn't even notice it. We wouldn't even notice the server. You know, you're at a cafe, you're talking with your friends, and the server comes and wipes up something on your table. You don't even notice it. You don't even pay attention to the server. If you're like involved with your friends, unless you want the server to come and bring you another drink. And then when he doesn't come, you get really annoyed. And, you know, you like try and get his attention or something. Very different. So that context that in a retreat like that, you know, where the whole activity of it is stepping out of the confines of the self. It's designed for that. And everything becomes important then. And that's why we say, like, you know, the person who makes the coffee is as important as the person ringing the bells. The person handing out the sutra books is as important as the person giving the Dharma talk. The people cleaning the toilets, that's as important as doing the accounts. It's all important. And that's the non-view. It makes life so much richer, actually. You know, there's that famous book from the 70s or 60s, I forget, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, right? So, you know, there can be Zen and the Art of Potato Salad. Zen and the Art of Your Life is actually the basic text for all of us. Too bad we don't do those Heart of Life retreats anymore. That was a really good experience.
Why not?
Why don't we do it? Yeah, we, you know, because the pandemic arrived and we started doing something else. But we could go back to it, absolutely. Definitely. And we found this way of being together, and suddenly, well, it was the response to the you know, COVID. Whereas before, it was a response to a different situation. I have a hard time, like, planning ahead. I always kind of just respond to the situation before me. So for better and worse, sometimes it's not so good at that. You need to be more structured. We may come back to that. Never know. as well.
Good evening, everyone. Roshi, you were giving that example during a retreat. The noticing the server taking out the towel to clean something on the floor, or the server forgetting to bow. We may notice that what makes it possible for us to notice something like that, it's because there is a structure, I guess. And actually what I was thinking was, it's not even like the structure, it's something you're supposed to follow. And yes, the server, in a way, the server is supposed to bow and he doesn't bow. But if there wasn't the structure that says that you make a bow at a certain moment, and then if that doesn't happen, you wouldn't notice it the same way. Or you wouldn't notice it. And something you also said was, you're referring to like a moment when we are sitting and we are, like you said, that when we are a monk, when we are one with what is at that moment. And then you said, and then it goes away, but it doesn't go, it just changes, the experience changes. Thoughts come again or something, and so the experience changes. And what I've lately, I was thinking that lately it has been difficult to sit, and the way I was thinking about this, because it's not difficult to sit, it's just that the experience in general has been there's a lot of thoughts, there's a lot of mental process, and there's not so much absence of that, let's say. So, but what I realized was, I don't know exactly how to say it. It's not the same thing, the experience is different, but let's say the mind allows for all of that. It's like it's the same mind. I don't know if this is correct, or I don't know what correct is. Well, anyway, it's the same mind that allows, or it comes from the same place or something, I don't know. I don't know exactly, you know, the same nature, it comes from the same place, it's the same mind, I don't know. And again, there's a structure, and that's in the structure, it's like the only purpose of the structure is to make me realize that. Otherwise, I wouldn't notice that I'm more distracted, or there are more thoughts, or I wouldn't notice the same way that there are not many thoughts. So with the structure, it's different, the awareness of what's happening.
And when you're referring to structure, it's a discipline, a regimen that helps us to not to experience the impersonal instead of the personal. So usually we're experiencing we're eating what I want to eat, we're eating when I want to eat, for walking, when I want to walk and how and where, sleeping when I want to sleep and waking up when I want to get up. Whereas when we submit to the, you know, the framework, to the regimen, what did you call it? I forgot. The structure, you said the structure. Yeah. The regimen, the discipline, whatever it is, then that immediately, it's like when we chant, we all chant together. So we're all engaging in the same thing at the same time. And that allows us to have this experience of the impersonal and not experience only the person. Like singing in a choir, you know, of course your voice is there and you hear your voice, but it's joined with these other voices. And it makes a beautiful sound. And if one voice passes, you know, if we're like, I've told this story before, Donna used to in the old days, there was one person, one woman who used to come, and you could all, when the chanting was happening, like if you were downstairs, if you were in the kitchen or something, and they were chanting upstairs, you could always hear that woman's voice. She didn't try to be one with the other voices. She tried to make her voice heard. And what happens when we do these, you know, the structure, as you say, or the discipline, however you want to call it, it's collective. We join in this collective instead of just the one. And yet the thing is that we are becoming one. Many is becoming one. But it can't be happening if one is still trying to be the one. It's like we say we only have one life. We have two lives. The second one begins when we see we only have one. So, you know, walking around thinking that we're separate from everyone and different and special. And yet when we join together and we're no longer that one, and we think we are, that exceptional special one, then we truly are ourselves and truly one. Monos, that's the monk comes from monos, one.
Thank you.
So it's true that structure is, that's what it's about. I don't know if, you know, it's intended, you know, if it's like making us do something, but it certainly is designed so that to help us let go of I. Yeah, that's for sure. So Lisa is connected on two, very interesting, the two Lisas. Which one is the true Lisa? Well,
and also, I think what you were saying, what you're both saying, is what makes those moments of how special it is to see the server take his napkin out. Because very often, this to me is the icing on the cake of retreats, is very often those moments are shared, just a glance across the room, or shared in the energy, even if it's not underlined. We're with this server together. And so it makes it even, I've been reading Thich Nhat Hanh this week in a book in which, and probably this is in all of his books, he really went on about the energy and the power of the breathing of all of us together, which we don't get all on the screen, but it's pretty good just to get this. But he was talking about that, and I'm so aware of that during retreat, is that we're all breathing together and having these little, I don't know, precious moments where across the room somebody sees the same thing that you see. That's why, for me, The best laughing in the whole world is when you're in retreat. Because something, it doesn't have to be much, but some little dorky thing, and you can, it can take you an hour to get over. And especially if you cross somebody else's look, and you notice that they're laughing too, then you're dead.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And sometimes there can be a, like we say in French, a fou rire, you know, like an absolutely contagious laughter in Zenda. And everyone, and it's kind of exacerbated by the fact that everyone is trying not to laugh. And it can be really intense. But one night in Belgium, myself and the other Roshi's other successors, we were together working on the rakusu that we gave her. And we just could not stop laughing. It was like, Michel Oltaten sensei is so funny sometimes. He has this like dry humor and he just kept cracking the jokes, you know, and we were just like rolling on the floor. Just like you say, some of the best laughter in those situations, because we're like open, we're open. That's the spirit of openness, kindness, tolerance, non-attachment to self, non-view. Yeah. We're very lucky, you know, to have these experiences with others and with ourselves. And I consider myself lucky to have found this practice that helps me to have those to experience life fully. I don't. Maybe I would have found it otherwise, but I certainly was not there when I. Before I started this practice. Claudia.
With the talk of tonight, I'm kind of in a big trouble because I think you enumerate absolutely every single thing I like to do. You know, like when we say the one who is singing another voice in the group, and the one who knows exactly what he wants to eat, and the one who wants it's. Okay, so it's precisely, I can see clearly that's precisely the way I behave. So it's very interesting to hear about that. And so tomorrow morning, I will try to sing the same verse than the other ones for the first time. And that was interesting what you were telling us about your sister, because I have the same experience with my brothers when they come here, and this is absolutely impossible for me to do what they want to do. So, okay, I can see here like an experience to something to experience and to let it go and just to spend time with them and go to Disneyland maybe and do things that I really think that are really hard for me, tough for me. But okay, maybe there is a way for me there. Okay.
Yeah, Disneyland might be a place of great opening, you know, depending on how you go there. It's true. Okay, well, thank you for being here and practicing and sitting and doing what you do. I guess we'll do the vows and
so only to say that anyway we choose to be here.
Yeah.
Today I can't speak very much, but I choose to be here. It's a choice. It's something we feel.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.